All right, folks, this is Todd Wilson, the host of the Lane 8 BMX podcast. And tonight, man, let me tell you something. If I just mention the name, you will know who in the world I'm talking about. And even at the young age that he's at right now, to me, he is a legend in BMX, and that is Connor Fields. And man, I've got the pleasure to sit down and talk to this man. And how we're going to do this interview tonight is we're not going to start at the beginning like I typically do to find out how they got into BMX. I think pretty much everybody knows your story, Connor, from that point. What I'm curious about is how are you doing now and what are you doing now? I just think, to me, if you don't mind me saying this, I kind of see you as a phoenix coming from the ashes and rebuilding yourself as a man to do other things and other great things. So without further ado, Connor Fields, thank you for coming on the Lane 8 BMX podcast.
Well, thank you. And it's quite the intro. I hope I live up to it.
Dude, you've lived up to everything so far, so I'm pretty sure this is easy. All right. So here's my thing. August 11th, 2022, you decide that you're going to retire from BMX. I'm curious of how was that decision, considering how it ended? I think the question would be, were you satisfied with where you were? And was that decision difficult?
Okay, so there's a lot of layers to this. So to answer the second part, yeah, absolutely, it was difficult. And then the satisfied thing, you know, yes and no. I think part of being an elite level athlete, part of being, you know, a high achiever is that you're never satisfied. Yep. You know, you win a race, it's like, oh man, I only won by this much. Or, you know, you win three championships and I wish it was four. You know, that's kind of how it always goes. You know, obviously nobody wants to end on a bodyboard. You know, everybody wants to have that fairy tale ending where you win and you sail off into the sunset. But it's so rare that that happens. But ultimately, you know, I had to wrestle with if I wanted to go out, you know, like that. But there was also the element of, you know, the realities of I had a significant brain injury and I had to figure out if that was something I was willing to risk again. Because, you know, the doctors told me, like, you could race if you want, but if you hit your head again, you're not going to be able to take a hit. So it's kind of like a boxer at the end of their career. They get knocked out real easy. So, and it wasn't a concussion. It was a traumatic brain injury for brain bleeds, and the scars of the brain bleeds will always be on my brain. So, you know, I'm always going to be at a higher risk of head injury. but that, you know, that internal competitor was like, ah, it's only 2 years to the next Olympics. I was 15 minutes away from possibly winning again, you know, and I had to wrestle with that. But ultimately what I decided was there's so much more to life. Life is so long. There's so many other amazing things that you could do and experience. And I didn't think that it was worth risking that to try to make my fourth Olympics or to try to do more of things I have already done. I would be lying if I didn't say that every now and then. I think to myself, like, ah, man, like, what if? Mm-hmm. But then at the same time, it's really easy just to remember where I was. And when I had to repass my driver's test, as an example,
wow.
And then I'm just thankful that I'm here and I'm okay.
Okay. I'm curious because I like to do research on the people that I interview. And the one thing that kept coming up about you was the closeness that you have with your parents. So my thought would be, what went into that decision in a sense? Obviously you spoke to your mom and dad because they were there from Jump Street. What was that like, that dynamic? Because they're seeing their son after 20 plus years leaving his life love, I would say, at one point when it comes to physical activity to now transitioning to something else. How did your parents play into that?
You know, I think my parents were smart and they knew that they gave the decision to me, you know, and they were always happy to talk about it. And whether it was my parents or friends or, you know, whoever I was talking to, nobody told me you have to do this. My sponsors were great. They said, hey, whatever you decide, we'll give you time. You know, I ultimately got to make the decision myself without any pressures. I found out afterwards that everybody was like, we were hoping that you would make that call. We were hoping that you wouldn't, you know, come back. But we knew that if we tried to, you know, influence that decision, that that wouldn't be the right thing because it has to come from within. But really, you know, I sat and I wrestled with it for a little while. And then there was a period of time where I considered coming back for one more race. And just maybe doing the grands or something. Yeah. Just that way, you know, I could go through the emotions of this is my last day and I could enjoy it. But what ultimately I came down to was, okay, cool. You know, let's go through the scenarios. I do it. I win. Get the fairy tale ending. Amazing. I do it. I get smoked because I haven't raced in a year and I had a year off when I was recovering. And my last memory is getting 5th and a quarter. Which is not something that I was ever okay with. Or what happens if I crash? What happens if I hit my head again and I came back just in, and could have been something completely out of my control. Maybe I'm running second and the rider in first goes down. What if I crash and I don't hit my head and I break my ankle? I mean, like, these are all the realities. And what I came to the conclusion was is that the good does not outweigh the bad enough to want to do that. And so everybody was really supportive. Everybody understood. And especially those close to me who knew the seriousness of it. I mean, my dad had to answer a phone call from the U.S. ambassador to Japan that basically said that if I died, he could fly to Japan and escort my body home. So, you know, they knew the level of seriousness. So I think for them, they're like, yeah, we get it. And I think people that maybe didn't know the level of seriousness, they might not understand it. But they weren't in the hospital room, you know what was going on.
Yeah. Do you think, now looking back on your career, Connor, I'm curious, and I'm glad I get to ask you this. Do you think that you got everything out of your talent?
Yeah, but I mean, that's back to the very first thing you said about being satisfied. I could always point, oh, I could have done this better. I could have done that better. You know, hindsight's always 20/20. But with that being said, you know, if you just rewind the clocks to 2007, 2006, when I was 14, 15 expert, I wasn't supposed to be the next big thing. You know, I didn't win my first NAG one till I was 16. Right. You know, right. As a kid, you know, I was good, but I wasn't, you know, the hot shot. And then even into, you know, when I started racing for Team USA, USA Cycling, I wasn't selected to the first World Cup I went to internationally in 2010. I wasn't picked for the team. You know, I got second place there. I was the only American who made the final, and I was never left off the team again.
Yeah.
But I wasn't supposed to be the guy. But that came out of grit and work and just not taking no for an answer.
Okay, I'm glad you said something because now I'm curious. You said that you weren't supposed to, if you look back, you weren't supposed to be the next hot thing. What is it that propelled you to where you got to? Because I'm curious of that, because there's a lot of people with good talent, but they don't get to where you got. So what was it that distinguished you from others?
We'll be right back.
Hey, quick question for you. Are you someone who wants to be fit, healthy, and happy? And what if I told you you could get your dream body by simply just listening to a podcast? I'm Josh.
And I'm KG, and we're the hosts of the Fit, Healthy, and Happy podcast.
Listen, we get it. Fitness isn't easy. Carbs, no carbs.
Just stop, okay? It doesn't have to be that complicated. And that's why we made this podcast. We get straight to the facts so you can become your best you.
So the way to check us out is click the link in the show notes or search Fit, Healthy, and Happy podcast on any of the major podcast platforms. We'll see you soon.
It's hard to say like one thing, right? Like I can't just point my finger and say this one thing. You know, I think that it was almost a benefit that I grew up in such a stacked class. Okay. And so I'll go into detail here. So in my junior elite year, so when I was 17, 18, so my age was myself, Corbin Schraw, Torin Ihog, Sylvan Andre, Twan Van Gent. And then the age above me was Sam Willoughby, Joris Daudet, Yelly Van Gorkum, Renato Resende, Anthony Dean, You know, so when we were racing junior, that's who was in your moto and in your semi, and not everybody could make the main. Yeah. So, you know, growing up racing against that group of guys, and then Corbin and I battled sometime when we were kids, and Corbin always won. He was the guy, and I just chased him around. But it really brought everybody's level up, and because everybody was just trying to compete. And then if you look, I wrote an article for 15 BMX. If you look at the people who have won championships in the past decade, like 85% of them are from that year. And, you know, there's like, there's a whole bunch of years before and after that, that nobody ever won a championship because they couldn't get through that, that block of guys. Yeah. But I think that we all just helped raise each other's level because we had no choice. And then for me, I think just losing my whole childhood, you know, taught me how to work and how to fight and scratch and claw. And, you know, I don't think that anybody who ever watched me race would ever say that I was not ever giving 100% every single time. Yeah. So I think that really came from that.
Okay. All of that what we've talked about now is transitioning to, into what is going on right now. And the thing that I find interesting is, do you use all of that, that hard work, the determination and things like that into what you're doing now? Is, can you use that in the sense of Outdoor Nevada? I understand you are the host. How did that come about, and how do you apply all of that hard work from racing in your pro career, amateur to pro, to now?
Yeah, I think, you know, I'll go back even, I'll take it back further as being a kid. You know, I think one of the best things about sports and youth sports is that you can learn a lot about life, right? You can learn about hard work. You can learn about sportsmanship. You can learn about sacrifice. You know, you learn all these life lessons through sport. And I was very blessed that I was able to learn so much. You know, I started going to school in 2013, and it took me 9 years to graduate, but I graduated. Yep. And, you know, that was all time management and hard work and commitment and all things that I learned through BMX racing that, you know, helped get me across the finish line at 28 years old to get a degree. You know, and then as far as what I'm doing now, I did some stuff with the local PBS station when I was competing, some stories, some different things like that. Yeah. Just they're promoting as lead up to the Olympic stuff. And then when this TV show, it had a host for the first two seasons, and they were looking for a new host, and I had made a good impression on them, and they just called me, asked me if it would be something I'd be interested in doing. You know, what they were looking for was somebody who was young, athletic, and from Nevada who could do the outdoors things. So it just fit really well. And then, yeah, I mean, I'm taking the same approach. Like when I raced, I wanted to be the best. Right. And I've got this horrible habit of whatever I do, I want to be the first, biggest, best. You know, it's just, it's so ingrained in my personality. And so, you know, I watch film of my hosting job and I analyze it. I could be better here. I could do this better. That was good, but I could be better there. And that's something I would do with racing. And I really only know how to do things one way, and that's to full gas, try to be the best. I don't, you know, it's a messed up thing that I have. I don't know how to do something halfway.
That's, was it type A personality?
Yeah. Yeah. I think capital A underlined with an exclamation point.
I like it. I like it. Okay. So tell me this, how does it work? How do you guys come up with the stories? Is it a round table situation? How often do you shoot? And go from there if you don't mind.
Yeah. So there's a producer who produces the show. And there's certain, it's for PBS, public broadcasting. So there's certain categories and certain regulations and things that we can and can't do because of that. But they are always looking for different stories and things that we can cover, whether it's a waterfall, a hiking trail, you know, going fly fishing at a certain lake. You know, we're going to old abandoned ghost towns in Nevada, or, you know, we went to multiple petroglyph sites this year, and, you know, just some cool, interesting stuff like that. And then because, you know, I'm able, we did three episodes that'll include mountain biking. You know, we're doing stories about that. We're doing, you know, kayaking and stuff next season, like some more like active stuff, which is cool. But yeah, basically I get an email with the schedule of what we're doing. And, you know, it was like a 3-month period that we shot, and it was kind of week on, week or two off, week on, week or two off. And we would drive, and Nevada's huge. I mean, we would drive sometimes if we went up north 9 hours to get up to the northern part of the state. And then depending on what we were doing, we would stay in a hotel, or if we were, I mean, we had a story where we tracked a herd of bighorn sheep and we camped 30 miles off of the road, because we were tracking bighorn sheep.
And
so, you know, it's a little bit of everything, but it's a cool way to see the state. Yeah. And, you know, I'm having a blast. It's an awesome time, and I'm going to kind of just see where this takes me and what I can turn it into and go from outdoor Nevada, and maybe it turns into something else, you know, maybe follow in the footsteps of another Vegas BMX guy, which is TJ Lavin, who now has a hosting career in TV as well.
Not bad. I was the one I was thinking about was Matt Polkamp.
Yeah, he's an actor. Matt's an, I was actually chatting with him the other day.
Oh, really?
He was saying that he'd love seeing what I'm doing, and if I ever want to get into acting, to give him a call. But I don't know. I don't know if I could do that. That'd be a tough one.
I love it. I love it. You not only are you doing that, I've heard that you're doing some. You're actually an agent.
So I was. I did my senior internship for college.
Yeah,
with my agent, basically as his assistant, and I thought it was great. It was a lot of fun. And I wanted to do it a little more seriously. And so I started doing that for a little bit, and I still am. There was some office politics and some people that didn't want me in the fold. And so that path has kind of closed off. But, you know, everything happens for a reason. And I learned a ton while doing it. And, you know, moving forward, I'll be able to take some of the stuff I've learned and do other things with it.
Not bad. You are doing some public speaking, but you're also doing some coaching. How does it feel now to coach? And I got my caveat to you is this: being how talented and successful in BMX that you have been, I have to ask this. Is it easy for you to spot talent?
Yeah. So it's two things. We'll start with the coaching thing. So, you know, I enjoyed coaching and doing clinics. And to be honest, I prefer doing like beginner clinics. Like really? I love teaching a kid how to balance in the gate or how to get his wheels off the ground for the first time or how to teach a young girl how to pump or, you know, that stuff to me, like that raw, that joy, that excitement, that's really fun. You know, I enjoy coaching at the high level. Like right now I'm helping out Joey Lito. I've been for a couple of years and, you know, seeing huge progress with him to where now he's establishing himself as a guy. He's just a nice kid. Yes, and, yeah. And you know, that's fun as well. And I enjoy it. I'm a competitor. I want to help him win. But if I had to pick one, I think I'd pick the beginners, the kids. I think that's the most fun.
Not bad.
But not bad. I think what it comes from is that I was at a high level for so long that like I got all my competitive juices out and now I just want to have fun with it.
Yeah.
To answer your question, yeah, I can spot talent big time. I can tell you which – I could look at these 15, 16, 17-year-olds and tell you which kids are just physically matured at a young age and the other kids are going to catch them and they're not going to be that good in a few years. And I could tell you the kid that's, you know, bebopping around in fourth place who hasn't grown yet, but when he grows or she grows, it's on. You know, right. I can see that pretty clearly. And then I could just see, you know – watching some of the pro racing now, which riders have certain tendencies, which riders have certain things that are going on. And I always feel like if any of them pick up the phone and call me, I can help them really easily.
Yeah.
But it's because I've, you know, been a student of this game my whole life. And then, yeah, as far as the keynote speaking goes, you know, I'm the only Olympic athlete in the history of the Olympics who has both won the Olympics and nearly died at the Olympics. So it's a heck of a story and you learn a lot and it's all applicable to whatever you're doing, sales, business, you know, whatever it is. And so that's been a fun thing I've been doing for a few years as well.
Let me ask you this then. Is it easier for you to coach an adult or a kid? And the reason I ask you that is children are, I would say, are like an open book. They're easier because they haven't learned bad tendencies. Adults, physically more, I would say, apt. And which one's easier for you? And obviously you prefer the kids.
Yeah, I mean, it depends, right? So like if I'm doing a clinic, there's lots of times where I'll be out there and like it'll be a parent and a child, like a 40-year-old and a 9-year-old or something. Yeah. And I always talk to the 40-year-old and I say, hey, look, I just respect that you're out here. I think it's awesome that you're out here. You know, I don't want to push you too hard. You got work on Monday. So I don't, you know, so it's a totally different ballgame, you know, when you're doing that. But you know, then it's easier for me to explain certain concepts and things and they'll understand it.
Yeah.
But then physically it might be harder for them to apply because they're limited because they're, you know, 40 years old and they've got a few bulging discs and arthritis in their knees. but then when you have a kid, you know, they might physically have all the skills and the tools to do it, but they might not understand it. So as a coach, it's just about explaining it to them in a way that they understand it. Right. Yeah. And so that's a good coach can explain the same concept 5 different ways to make the pupil understand what they're trying to get across.
Not bad. Not bad. Is what type of style of a coach are you? Are you in this, in a sense, a taskmaster in the sense of, hey, this is what I'm telling you to do. Get it done. Or are you, here's the plan. Let's massage it and get it done.
Again, that comes down to who it is. Individual. And a certain athlete. And so if a certain athlete is a little bit more sensitive and needs a little bit more massaging, then maybe they're going to get it. Or maybe they, you know, for their own personal development, need to not be massaged because maybe their parent and their team manager and everybody else around them, you know, holds their hand, holds their hand and babies them. So I'll be the one that puts a little bit of toughness in it. I'll be the hard ass. You know, and it's just about figuring out what they need. And then also just being aware of the situation. Like, you know, as an example, on race day, and this will be more aimed at the high level stuff, like the pros, right? On race day, you're so sensitive to what's going on around you. So if I'm standing there and I'm nervous and anxious and fidgeting, they're going to pick up on that. And so even if I'm freaking out and I'm nervous and I'm stressed, I got to just stand there calm and cool as a cucumber and make them think that I'm not worried one bit because that they're going to feed on that. And I remember, you know, I think that's an advantage of being on both sides. I remember when I was competing, like there were certain people that I just didn't want to be around on race day because their anxiety would make me feel anxious. And then there's other people that made me feel calm just based on their presence. And so I try to be that to the people around me.
Not bad. Not bad. I want to go back a little bit. You started at 7 years old. Mom found a flyer at a bike shop.
Yep.
I read that from the first time that you hit Nellis BMX, it was over. You knew what you wanted to do and eventually stopped every sport. Were you good from the get-go or was it just you had to really work at it?
No, it was good. Yeah, there's definitely natural talent for sure. Like, I won the Olympics. Like that doesn't happen without a level of natural talent straight up. Like, yeah, there's work. Yeah. There's things you got to do, but you have to at least start at a base level of natural talent to get there. so yeah, I mean, I BMX came really easy to me. I mean, this is back in the days where there was 2 sanctions. It was NBL and ABA and being a Vegas kid, it was NBL. And I went to the grands the first year I raced intermediate. I won the grands as an intermediate 7-inner. Then, you know, the next year I came back as an 8X and I won again, right? BMX was easy. I was national champ within 16 months of racing.
Yeah.
So then we went to an ABA race and I got smoked, right? We found out that ABA was harder than NBL. And, you know, and then I was, you know, straight back down to reality and trying to claw my way back up. But, yeah, I mean, like, I don't know how else to put it other than like I was talented and it, you know, I don't want to say it came easy to me because a lot of work and a lot of practice and a lot of repetition, but I had all the tools physically that I needed.
Not bad. Were you more of a, I would say when you got into your teenage years, were you more of a power rider or a skill rider or a mixer of both?
I was all skill when I was young because I grew late. So like I was like one of the last guys in my age to kind of hit puberty and grow. So like you see pictures of me when I was 13, 14 years old and I'm standing next to whether it was Corbin or Jared Garcia or Nighthawk, guys like that, and they were 6 inches taller than me. You know, I ended up taller than all of them, but at the time, you know, I was the last to grow. My first driver's license when I was 16, it said 6'170". You know, when I raced, I was 6'200". You know, so I was just a string bean. So I was all skill until maybe 18, 19. And then when I was able to build some physical strength, then I kind of became a balance of the two. And even at the end, you know, I was a strong physical rider at the end. And I didn't have that, like, laissez-faire, Joris Corbin looks like I'm not trying style. But I was just as smooth. I could run a lap time just as quickly. It just looked a little more forced. And ironically, I felt just as relaxed as they looked. Like, I didn't feel like I was trying that hard, but that was just the way that I did it in my style.
I loved your style. I was actually talking about it. God, what interview did I do a while back? And we were talking about you. And I was like, I enjoyed watching you always because it always seemed like you put everything into it. But you were, it looked like you were, sometimes people say you're all over the place, but in your mind, you're smooth because you're doing it your way.
Yeah, well, it's like I was all over the place or whatever, but I mean, realistically, how many times did you see me crash when it wasn't with another rider? Like, I was all over the place, but I crashed in my memory, like, one time, I think, on my own accord, when it wasn't another rider, a mechanical, a flat tire, or something like that, yeah. In like 10 years. You know, sure, maybe there's a slide out here and there in a turn, but it doesn't really count. But yeah, I mean, and I never felt like I was all over the place.
Not bad. You won 3 NAG titles?
As an amateur?
Yeah.
Three if you count Cruiser, but Cruiser once and then Class twice, I think.
What was that decision like at a young age to turn pro?
Well, I actually was forced to stay down 1 year. I didn't want to. So in 2009, I signed with Free Agent. It was a 2-year contract. It was a 2-year amateur contract. At the time, the pros were Merritt Schombers, Kyle Bennett, and Christian Besserine. So there was, you know, they had a powerhouse team.
Yeah.
And I was an amateur, and their kind of long-term plan was that they were going to have me come in as Christian and Kyle aged out after London 2012. But then I got good way quicker than anybody expected. And then so in 2009, I podiumed at the Chula Vista World Cup when I was 16. Yep. And, you know, and then at that point, the following year, I was all gung-ho. I was like, let's go pro. I'm ready. You know, Corbin Straw went pro that year. And so that was the kid I grew up racing, and he raced pro. And, this is back when there was A pro. So you would go A pro for the year, and then you had that year transition. But the team manager said, no, we signed you as an amateur. This is the second deal of your second year of your contract. You have to stay amateur. So I stayed amateur that year to go for the, you know, amateur title, which realistically, like, you could do everything you could do, but if another class has more riders, there's just nothing that you could do.
Yeah, it's riders.
And so I got second in the amateur title that year to Josh Klatman, because he had more riders than Grant.
Yeah.
And, you know, so the year was, I don't want to say it was a wash, but it was almost a bit of a waste of time because I wasn't bettering myself because I was beating up on riders that for lack of a better way to put it, like I was ready to be pro and I shouldn't have been racing against these guys, but I had to stay down. So that's kind of what happened. And then when it was 2011 and it was time to go, I said, let's go. And it was on.
Wow. Do you remember your first pro race? Do you remember how you felt? How do you remember it at all in the sense of just where in your mind, where were you?
Yeah. So I almost had 3 first pro races. So the rules were very different back then.
That's interesting. So,
there's a lot of differences, right? So I raced a World Cup when I was still an amateur. Yep. I think I raced World Cup on Saturday in Chula Vista, and I was pre-signed for 17-18X on Sunday at the amateur track. you know, obviously I didn't race it after I podiumed, I'm not racing this tomorrow, but so that was like my first pro race. But then at the same time that next year, this is before UCI and USA BMX were on the same page. So you could race UCI and race pro and then race amateur on the same day. So I raced elite men at the Boulder City National in 2010. And then 3 weeks later, I raced 17-18X at the Grands. So I didn't have a pro license, but I was racing a UCI pro license because it was just by the age. There's a whole thing.
Yeah.
And then my first actual pro race in 2011, I did 1 day of A pro. I won. And then the next day I turned myself double A, went 666 in motos, got destroyed.
Wow.
And then after that, that was kind of when things got started after that.
Okay. So you went 666. Obviously the transition to double A was a lot tougher. What did you notice was the difference?
Kinda. I mean, that was at the Great Salt Lake National in June. I made the main at the Worlds in July at Elite Men. So like I just had a bad day. I think I just got in my head that day, and like I got second in the Grands that year in double A. So it's like, I think it was just that one day that was tough.
Holy cow, man. This is crazy. Okay. Okay. Tell me this. Did you prefer racing World Cup or USA BMX tracks? Which one did you prefer and why?
Well, by the end, more than half of the USA BMX series is on World Cup tracks. So now it's one and the same, right? You go back to the first year I raced USA BMX in 2012 or 13. No supercross hills, all traditional tracks, totally different. It's two different sports, to be honest, at this point. Like the Grands, small hill, dirt turns, small track, pedal manuals, the last straight is tiny. It doesn't even count, that's a totally different ball game than the Tokyo track, which is 40 seconds long, massive, 3 meter starting hill. It's so different. Your bike setup's different. Your gears are different. The way you train is different. Everything you do is different. And so in order to race USA BMX, you have to be good at both. But it almost comes, in my opinion, at this point in time, it almost comes at a little bit of a hindrance because the people racing here in the States are having to be good at two different disciplines when the people overseas are really just focused on one. And they can dedicate all of their time to that. And so while Cameron Wood and Cameron Larson and the boys are racing on Black Mountain BMX, which I have no problem with traditional BMX, I'm gonna put that out there. I don't have an issue with it.
Yeah.
But they're racing dirt turns, dirt hill, old school BMX style, where the whole rest of the world is just smashing gates on supercross hills.
Wow. Did you do a lot? Let me ask you this. This is the one thing I'm curious. Did you do any European Cup racing?
Yep, I raced one. I raced Zolder in 2015. The Worlds were going to be there, so I raced it as a prep. I've raced one Euro round. I won it, so I'm undefeated at Euro rounds.
Mother Humber, God dang it!
I just never raced another one. So
hey, you're above 500, right?
100%. Okay.
So here's my question: do you think that the tracks? I've heard this a lot. I've interviewed a lot of elite riders. Do you think the tracks are tougher in Europe than in America?
It's not even a question. Straight up. Here's the difference. And I remember in 2015, I tweeted something about this. Like the U.S. went to Zolder, got smashed. Like it was like the U.S.'s worst world ever. Not an elite, like in amateurs.
Yeah.
And I just posted something about like it was so obvious watching all. Okay. I posted something saying it's so obvious watching all these American riders struggle. When we're racing in rodeo arenas like the South Point, and then wondering why when we go to these races, the riders aren't equipped to handle these tracks. Now it's gotten better, right? There's more bigger tracks in America. It's improved. But here in the States, people don't want a novice. And I understand from both sides, like if you're a track operator, you don't want a 7-year-old kid who's coming out for the first time to have a bad experience. You want them to come out and feel comfortable and feel safe and want to come back. And if the track's too gnarly and too big, they're not going to do it. And if people don't come to your track closes down and there's no more track, right? So I get it. I also understand that if you're a 7-year-old kid and you show up at you know, Sarasota or Rock Hill or one of these crazy huge tracks, like that's a lot. Like that's not easy. So I understand both sides of the coin. But facts are facts. America has the easiest tracks in the world, period.
Okay. You hear from Connor Field right there.
Period.
What do we have to do? Because what do we have to do to prepare? Besides the tracks, it just seems like everybody and their mama has passed the United States when it comes to racing BMX. And this was where the birth of BMX started. This is where it's from. How do we catch up other than the tracks?
I'm going to do a whole other podcast on that one. That's a long answer. No, and I don't think every track needs to be crazy, right? Yeah. Like, I don't think, you know, I think it's already headed in a better direction than it was a few years ago, because now with Houston and Rock Hill and Sarasota and Louisville and Tulsa, like, there are bigger tracks popping up.
Yeah.
So, you know, you do have more access to push your skills if you so choose. And, you know, any rider getting ready to go over and race in international worlds, because the Rock Hill Worlds is on an easy track. Rock Hill's easy comparatively to what Scotland was last year, way easier. And I'm not saying whether that's good or bad. I'm just saying that, you know, you just look at the size and how technical those tracks are. The worlds in Scotland or the worlds, you know, in Azerbaijan or some of these other, you know, international worlds, the tracks are bigger.
Yeah.
Sleeman, where the worlds are going to be in 2026, Australia is massive. Yeah. But if, you know, before these riders go overseas, you know, you want to go and ride some of these bigger tracks and just get used to it, right? I live in Vegas. I've got four great tracks here. I love them. I grew up racing them. Yeah. Nothing but respect for the track operators. But riding these tracks does not get you prepared for what you're going to see over there.
Wow. Wow. Is it also the funding that is the problem? Because I look at the Dutch. I look at the French. Who else could I say? Man, just let's go with those two. The funding for those teams is amazing. Those riders don't. It's almost like they're fully funded. If they make the team, that's all they live for. That's not the same for the United States when it comes to racing.
Yeah, kind of. It's all public information. You can go to usdecycling.org and find out what the funding levels are. Like,
yeah,
it's all public. It's, you know, you're on the highest level of funding. You get $2,000 a month. Then the next level down is $1,000 a month. So that doesn't include that you get funded to go to the events and you get your training is paid for. You know, you don't have expenses, but there's not enough to live, right? So then what ends up happening is you have to have a sponsor, right? And so, you know, your sponsor says, okay, cool, you've got to go to these USA BMX races. You've got to do this, this, and this for your sponsor. So in order to make your living, you have to do additional things. Whereas, you know, the French or the Dutch, their federation might say, hey, you know, we're going to pay you, it's not much, like we're going to pay you $3,000 a month, but we're also going to pay your room and board. We're going to pay for your meals. You're going to have no expenses. Your only job is to eat, sleep, and train and race BMX. And then they don't have to do anything else to go and earn, you know, on every decision they're making is to go try to win a World Cup event, because that's what matters to them. Yeah. Whereas, you know, for an American, it's almost a bigger deal to win a USA BMX title than it is to win a World Cup. But the US is the only country in the world that views the USA BMX title as more valuable than a World Cup, because the World Cup is how you get to the Olympics. Like, as an example, Cameron Larson winning three of the first four USA BMX races this year means zero for Olympic qualification. Means nothing.
Wow, are you serious?
Yeah, there's no UCI points, and all of the Olympic qualification criteria is based off of World Cup events. It means nothing. He could win every single USA BMX round.
Yeah.
He'd go undefeated, but if he doesn't perform at the World Cups, he has no shot at making the Olympics. And I'm not saying that's right or wrong, but that's just the facts of the matter.
Yeah, yeah. Wow, I didn't know that. I thought it had a little bit of it, nothing.
UCI Sunday counts as points for country ranking, but it doesn't count for anything for individual, like who gets the spot. It just counts for accumulative scores for your countries.
So how do we change this for America to produce better riders? What can we do?
Well, you know, I think this is one of my favorite things that people say, is like, oh, America's so bad. America's so bad.
I won't say it's bad. I'm just saying for us to be able to compete at an international level where we're having let's say, riders finish making the main more often?
In elite?
Yes.
Okay. So let's just look at the big kahuna here. We'll just throw some facts, okay? Big kahuna of the Olympics, that's what dictates everything.
Sir.
There's only one country that has scored more medals than the United States. It's Colombia. Colombia's won 6 because Mariano's got 3 herself, and then they've got 3 men medals. The U.S. has 5. We've won 5 medals. So we're second. Do you know how many men, how many French men do you think have ever won an Olympic medal?
None.
0.
Yeah.
But everybody looks at France as the powerhouse, but they've never done the big one, right? So then let's go back to Tokyo. Felicia got 4th, okay? You just change a little bit there. Like, if I don't go down and the entire U.S. isn't, you know, worried that I'm dead, maybe I go and let's just say I get 3rd. And then let's say Felicia's in a better mindset. Let's say she gets 3rd. And now we just scored medals again. And we've scored medals at 3 of the 4 Olympics. And now we've got 7 total as a nation. So, you know, it's not like it's as bad as people are saying or think it is. Right. And Cameron Wood won a World Cup last year. You know, Elise Post and Felicia Sansel both podiumed World Cups last year. Like, America's still competitive. We're still good. I think what it is just as an American culture, if America's not dominating and getting 4 out of the 8 in the main, we suck. And that's just American culture.
That Cam Wood boy, that's a bad boy right there.
Yep.
Jeez, God dog. I know we got a little bit of time here. I'm curious. I want to run a couple of things by you. Outside of the Olympics, would you take a world championship jersey or a World Cup overall win? And why?
So I want everything it's possible to win except for the world championship jersey. I won the time trials twice. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I whole shot at the world's main event and I was winning in the second turn, but I'd never crossed the line. I got the rainbow jersey. That one I would say is probably after the Olympics, that's number 2 for 99% of riders, you know, would be to win the rainbow jersey world champion. It's just the most prestigious that you can get outside of the Olympics.
Yeah. You won something. And I'm curious. I wrote this down because I wanted to ask you about this. It says you won it twice, 2014 and 15. It's the North American Continental Champion. Can you explain that to? Because I've never heard of that.
Yeah. So, you know, UCI, which is the Union Cyclist International.
Yep.
They have different categories of races that count for different amounts of points for country Olympic qualifying. Okay. So if you think about it, there's 24 spots on the gate of the Olympics. 12 countries get a spot. That's it. So not every country gets to race. And if your country is ranked 13, your country doesn't race. And so there are big countries, you know, I think Italy was the one who missed last time round. And like, there were some big name countries that, you know, because it fills up pretty quick, right? You go America, Canada, Colombia, Brazil, France, Holland, England, Germany, Australia, New Zealand. That's 10.
Yeah.
I mean, no riders from all those, right? Yeah. Like, and so any of the other smaller countries, Japan, you know, or, you know, Czech Republic or any of the, like, it's hard to fill a spot in the gate. So the Continental Championships are a category of race similar to the National Championships, the World Championships, World Cups, C1 events, which is what UCI Sundays are, HC events, which are, you know, another type of event. It's just different types of events. Yeah. So the Continental Championships in North America is kind of silly because it's America, Canada, and Mexico. But the Continental Champs for Europe are huge. Because that's the European Championships.
Yeah.
So when you see Europe race the European Championships, that's just their Continental Championship. But there's so many more countries in their Continental Championship. And actually, I think after 2016, they combined North and South America. And so this year, you'll see Americans go to Bogota, Colombia, for the Continental Championships because it's North and South America combined.
I bet. You also won the Pan Am Games.
Yep.
Holy cow. Was that Guadalajara?
Guadalajara, 2011, 100 years ago.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. Was that a goal of yours?
I didn't even know what that was until, you know, kind of before it, right? Like, it's the Olympics for North and South America. So it's an Olympic style event. It's all the different sports. You stay in a village, you do all the things. Some countries, it means a lot more, like Colombia, you know, some of the South American countries, it means a lot. In America, nobody really follows it because, you know, America wins so many medals at the Olympics themselves.
Yeah.
That people, you know, aren't going to get excited for not a world event. But I went 11, I went again in 15. And then when 2019 came around, you know, myself and Corbin turned down the spots. We said we didn't want to go. We'll let, you know, some of the other kids go because, and here's the hard facts, the truth. You know how much money I made for winning the Pan American gold medal?
How much?
$0.
Are you serious?
You don't get any money for it. There's no prize money. Your sponsors, the sponsors aren't going to give you a bonus for it because you're wearing your Team USA stuff and, you know, nobody knows what it is. Or, you know, do you know who won the Pan Am Games last year?
Cam Larson.
Okay. You know who won it the time before?
I don't.
Do you know who won in 2007 at the inaugural one?
No.
Jason Richardson.
Jason, that's right. Oh, I was coming. Okay, I could have come with that.
So, but you know, it doesn't mean anything to your sponsor. So, like for somebody like Cam Larson, he's young, he's getting experience. You know, there's a lot of value there outside of financially. But when you're 28 years old and you've already won and you've already had the experience, you know, you're not going to go risk breaking your leg for $0.
Wow. Okay. I got to ask you about this one because, man, when you were sponsored by Polo. Dude, okay, come on, man. How did that come about? And I saw the pictures. My man was looking Dapper Dan up there with the Polo stuff, baby.
It happened because we were at an event in the Olympic Training Center in Chula Vista. And they had an athlete panel that was doing kind of a Q&A for some of the Olympic team sponsors. And, you know, one of the marketing people from Polo was there and, you know, thought that I was well-spoken and fit their brand image and things like that. And so, you know, I signed with them for the 2016 games and then re-signed again for the 2020 games. And, you know, all of the Olympic team sponsors, whether it's McDonald's, you know, Polo, Nike, you know, all those part of the contract is that they have to sponsor a certain number of Olympic athletes. And I was very lucky, you know, most of the time it goes to the swimmers and the track and field, the kind of the Michael Phelps of the world. But I was just lucky, you know, that the BMX kid made a positive impression on someone from Polo and ended up getting that.
Okay, hold on. So you're not going to blow by that one. Was it unlimited clothes? I mean, were you wake up, you got the Polo drawers on, the T-shirt, everything, a Polo cologne. I mean, what was it?
Well, you know, there's NDAs in the contract, right? So I can't tell you exactly. But what I can tell you is that there was a gift card to the Polo store as part of the compensation, and it wasn't small.
God dog. Okay, so now that you're not racing, last couple of questions. Now that you're not racing, how is it with, you're obviously still with Chase and Monster. Will that continue on for however long? And
I think it'll continue as long as I want to, you know, remain involved in the sport, right? If I ever decide one day that I want to go and be a firefighter or something, then it might not. You know, with Chase, I think I'll always be a brand ambassador. I was there from day number one. I helped name the brand. There's five of us who voted on the name. And, you know, it was between Chase and something else. And I voted Chase. but I do feel a little bit of a connection to the brand. I do feel like I helped build. Now, I was the only rider on the team for 3 years. So I feel a good connection to the brand. So I'll be, you know, working with them in some capacity forever. I won't ever ride a different type of bike. And then as far as Monster goes, you know, they have, you know, been loyal and stuck by me. I think this is year 12 that I've been with them. And, you know, they just like to have somebody that's still out of the BMX track and at the BMX races and, you know, has their brand out there.
Okay. I read somewhere where you looked in the mirror one day and you're like, I need to get back in the gym. So how's I say that smile. How is that going with you? I mean, now that you're not fully racing on, how does it feel to get back into the gym and get that physical fitness back?
Yeah, I mean, I took a break. You know, it was well earned, right?
Yeah.
But I think as an athlete, you're so used to feeling good, and you're so you know what good feels like. Like, you know how good you can feel. So I didn't like when I wasn't feeling good, and I got back into it. But I'm just enjoying doing things that I couldn't do before. You know, whether it's I played rec league softball. I played softball for a season just for fun. You know, just doing new things, and I'm going to the gym, and sometimes I'm doing squats and deadlifts like I used to, and other times I'm doing curls and bench press and doing beach body stuff. Why? Because I can't. I couldn't do it for the longest time, so now I can.
Okay. Last two questions. What's the best advice that Connor Field has ever gotten, whether it's in BMX or just in life in general?
It's heavy. It's a lot. I don't know. That's put me on the spot for that one. I don't know exactly, you know, I can't pick one, but the first one that comes to mind, I got advice from my team manager on free agent when I was 16 years old. And I was upset because, you know, some of the other riders in the pro class, you know, weren't welcoming to a kid. And he said, don't stress out on it. Your real friends will call you on Monday.
Ooh, that's good.
And that stuck with me forever. And I never cared if people liked me. I never cared if I respect anybody who's getting up on an 8-meter hill and going. I have nothing but respect for you. But if I'm not going to call you on Monday and you're not my friend, I don't care. Like, cool. Shake your hand. Good luck. Shake your hand after. Well done. Don't care. You're just a competitor. And I think that's unique because in the BMX world, I think a lot of people want to be friends and friendly with everybody. And there's a lot of fakeness.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's just real. And so, you know, I'll just use it as an example. Like Sam Willoughby and I, we weren't friends. We didn't fake it. We didn't. We shake hands at the podium and, you know, we were respectful of each other, but we were real. And, you know, now we're fine because there was no fakeness. So we could sit and we could talk about old stories or whatever and not care because there was never any fakeness. And I preferred that over the fake.
I respect that. My last question to you is this. Where does Connor Fields see himself in the next 5 to 10 years? Are you married? Do you have kids? What are you doing?
Neither of those two things, but I don't know. And that's a whole new adjustment for me and something that I'm working on getting comfortable with because my life used to revolve in 4-year cycles and I knew exactly where I was going to be and what I was going to be doing. And I'm trying to enjoy the unknown. You know, a year ago today, never would have guessed I'd be hosting a TV show and doing some of the things I'm doing now. So just trying to keep an open mind and who knows what I'll be doing in 5 years, but I hope it's great.
You got it. Everybody, this is Connor Fields. I think the greatest BMXer out of the United States, one of the best in the world, a true legend, scholar, and a gentleman. Thank you for coming on the Lane 8 BMX podcast.
Thanks for having me.
You got it.